Hello, 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 everybody. I am Pedro.
And I'm Meredith.
That is my softly spoken wife, and we are here to talk about movies today. And today, we're going to be talking about one of the greatest films of all time, in my humble opinion.
In my opinion as well.
Yeah, I don't think it's really controversial to say Alien is a damn good movie. And we're covering it because Romulus comes out in a week, and we want to be prepared for it, and we want to talk about this movie.
I can't help but say the Aliens with the S at the end.
Yes.
Is my favorite of the
series. That's your favorite of the series?
Yeah.
It is mine as well. I do love this movie.
I do too.
But I love Aliens a little bit more.
Better than the second one.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And listen, I think if you're ready to go to war with us over that simple fact that we love Aliens a little bit more than we love this movie, what's the best way for people to express that opinion to us?
You can email us at grittyrebootcast@gmail.com. And then you could also go to our social medias, which I don't have any idea what are.
You just go to TikTok and you go to Instagram and YouTube and you search Gritty Reboot. Easiest way to find us.
Good.
That's right. And you can follow us there. We do all sorts of fun stuff. We sometimes game stream. We say that and we haven't done it in like a month and a half.
I know.
Yeah. Every time I bring it up, Meredith's like, no, don't bother.
Whatever.
Don't do it. You're never going to make it. But anyway, so MacReady walks in with the shredded underwear. No, we're not going to.
No time for MacReady.
Ugh, come on. There's always time for a thing reference.
Is there?
Yes, there always is. Mm. So, Alien, do you have an early memory of watching it for the first time?
I can say for a fact, I remember never wanting to watch this movie as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
I was freaking terrified of Alien. I don't know why. The fact that he came out of vents and stuff.
Yeah.
There was this X-Files episode where this guy like steals people's organs and lives in vents.
Yeah, it's a classic episode.
Yeah.
He stretches. He was the same guy from The Green Mile, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that actor. Whose name I can't remember.
It stuck with me as a kid. And I think the fact that the alien creature comes out of vents and creeps around really freaked me out. So I never wanted to watch this movie. I didn't see this movie until probably we were together.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know it was that late.
Yeah, it was that late.
I really don't have like an introduction to Aliens, because I had seen Aliens first, you know, I just happened to catch that movie on TV and I was aware of it. I think when I became of age and could start watching movies, that was probably really popular, like on TBS. It probably had just finished its run on HBO. It was probably all over basic cable. You know how that used to happen back in the day.
Yeah.
Once that Blockbuster, you know, once Transformers finally got to TNT, they would air the fuck out of it for like 5 years, right?
Yeah.
And that's the same thing it was with Alien. So I watched that movie like 1,000 times. And then I watched the one before. And I really liked it, but I just don't have a memory of it because I was exposed to Alien before. That's the movie I have a little bit full. I mean, we just talked about it. We prefer that film a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I do have some fonder memories of Aliens necessarily than Alien, the original film.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just the way it goes. Once again, it's no slight to this movie. I think it's one of the greatest horror movies ever made.
I agree. I absolutely agree. For 1979, this movie's a bomb-ass movie.
It is a bomb-ass movie. It's the bomb diggity.
Yeah.
It's the bomb.com. Do we need more bomb references? But no, it is what it is. It truly is an amazing film.
It's a classic.
So listen, there's one thing I want to talk about before we get into facts and stuff like that is there's a movie I always compare this to that it reminds me of. And that is 28 Days Later, because that movie is directed by Danny Boyle as this film was directed by Ridley Scott. And the thing I like about those two movies is they are giant genre changing horror movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have this one sci-fi classic that goes this direction with horror, and literally Danny Boyle, the guy who made Trainspotting, started the zombie craze.
Yeah.
Right? He did that. That was him. He made one movie on mini DV and he began the zombie craze. But the thing about those movies is that none of those guys were horror guys. And I think that is the secret sauce in those two movies, is they made a horror movie without any schlockiness, any camp. They came at it as a direct auteur. And because of that attitude, they fucking nailed it and they made something that was amazing.
Yeah.
By having a different perspective.
I mean, look at the movie's cinematography and like the sets.
Yeah, set design is brilliant. I showed you a video as we're doing our research. The sets were this intricate design. Like you could actually walk through the ship and it was laid out in a logical way. The set designer had said, no, this airlock is here because it needs it for this project. Like, he had worked out why those things needed to be where they were, why they were vents here. Like, he thought of all that, even if you didn't see it. And sure, we don't know about that, but we know about that as a viewer.
Yeah.
We can see those little details. There's an authenticity in this set that is, I mean, almost unparalleled. The work that George Lucas did, no, not George Lucas, he's just a director. There's, you know what I mean. A lot of fantastic people worked on Star Wars that helped achieve those amazing practical effects. Those guys laid a template, and I think Alien did a fantastic job on top of that with a gritty, grungy feel. Even things that are out of time or archaic, like the CRT monitors, work perfectly, right?
Yeah.
They fit that aesthetic so well. I mean, how much did we mark out for that plane, the Alien game, Isolation?
Yeah.
That was great, you know, when they say, oh, great, they're still CRT monitors, as they should be. Mm-hmm. You know, they never developed LCD tech in that universe. It just, it's one of those great little elements. So much fantastic art design.
Yeah, yeah, it's a beautiful movie.
It really is.
Yeah. From 1979, it's, and it's well acted, too.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a bad performance in this film.
Yeah.
I mean, even some of the smaller character actors are delivering career work here. I mean, you know, everyone treats this like a real movie. And that's the real difference, you know.
Was Sigourney Weaver popular before this movie?
No, she was a Broadway actress.
Oh, wow.
This broke her.
Oh, wow.
She became Sigourney Weaver off this one movie. She said, you know what? I know I've conquered Broadway. I'm going to do one movie and conquer Hollywood.
Damn.
Yeah, and she...
Go, girl.
This was, what was the budget? $11 million?
I don't know. I didn't write it.
I don't know if it was 11 or 8. I know it makes like $180 million. That's like $400 billion in today's money. But I mean, it made a lot of money for back then, especially off how low budget this film was. Do you want to get into your trivia first, or do you want me to generally talk about the birth of the movie?
Well, let's go through some trivia, shall we? Shredded condoms were used to create tendons of the beast's ferocious jaw. Oh,
I love all these little things like this. When some guy just got done banging a hooker, and he's got to wake up early, get to set, and he throws his rubber off, and he's like, wait a minute. I've got just the idea of what to do with it. Like, I don't know how that thought just occurred to him, that he was like, I know what to use. But, like, I'm always amazed by these practical guys and what they come up with to use to make incredible alien designs.
The blue laser lights that were used in the alien ship's egg chamber were borrowed from The Who. The band was testing out the lasers for their stage show in the soundstage next door.
No shit.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, listen, we got an idea. Come by, and then, you know, they probably came by and saw the set. Oh, this is super cool. And then they got creeped out by HR Giger.
Probably.
Yes. Hello. We'll get into Mr. Giger later.
For the chest burster sequence, Sir John Hurt stuck his head, shoulders, and arms through a hole in the mess table, linking up with a mechanical torso that was packed with compressed air to create the forceful exit of the alien. And lots of animal guts, which, according to Sigourney Weaver, caused the set to smell horribly.
Oh my God, I can only fucking imagine.
The rest of the cast were not told that the real blood and guts were being used so as to provoke genuine reactions of shock and disgust. Apparently this worked so well that Yaphet Kotto went home in a complete shock afterwards,
locking himself in a room
and refusing to talk to his wife for several hours.
Yeah, I've heard... Veronica Cartwright tell that story, actually, that he did that. For all I know, Veronica Cartwright could be the world's biggest bullshit.
I don't know.
You know, it could be like that Zelda Rubinstein thing. She's like, you know, who's a piece of shit? Toby Hooper. Like, you know, it just could be like one of those things where somebody has she just tells tall tales about a classic movie. But you can really tell by the way that scene hits those actors. I love, and y'all just talk about it right now since we're here, we'll break down the movie all the time, but Yaphet Kotto, like when that chest burster hits, he absolutely freezes. And it's so weird to compliment an actor for doing nothing.
Yeah.
But the idea that something happened that shocked him to his core, that he could not even move a muscle, is so convincing.
And there's a reason for
that. I mean, I was watching the scene as I was grabbing the clip, I was like, he doesn't blink. Like he's just transfixed when that blood shoots up. It's amazing. Like the second it happens, that moment of violence, it's such a shock. Other people do traditional things, but his just complete blankness almost horrifies me to know that, like, here's this guy who seems pretty down to earth and he saw just the most horrifying thing he's ever going to see in his fucking life.
Yeah.
Or up until that point.
Yeah. I have a fact about that.
Yeah. Let's keep talking. Let's go.
For the chest burster sequence, Oh, we already talked about that one.
False start. Cut it.
To get Jones the cat to react fearfully to the descending alien, a German shepherd was placed in front of him with a screen between the two, so the cat wouldn't see it at first. The screen was then suddenly removed to make Jones stop advancing and start hissing.
I always wonder how they get these reactions on animals.
Yeah.
Having worked with animals kind of briefly on set at times, sometimes it's kind of amazing. Other times it does take forever. So I'm always really curious how they get just that. Because sometimes that can end up taking like 4 or 5 hours just to get a cat to look or to walk one direction.
Mm-hmm. Takes a special type of trainer.
Yeah.
Some of these work with these animals forever, I guess.
It was a good idea. Either way, they got a good reaction out of the cat. It's weird to say, but like it's one of those movies where like every shot is iconic, basically.
I love that shot of the cat when he's looking up at the alien going up.
Yeah.
Yeah. The dead facehugger that Ash autopsies was made using fresh shellfish, 4 oysters, and a sheep kidney to recreate the internal organs. Filming had to be done quickly because the organic material would go bad very fast under the studio light.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, we're under these lights right now, and these lights don't put off anything, any for heat.
Yeah.
They get to be 95 degrees. Those other lights, you know, they could put off serious heat. I mean, they'll cook. That's what they're doing. They're slowly cooking all that meat inside that prop,
mm-hmm.
making just awful, awful smells.
I have another fact about the stage lights.
Yeah, they're hot. And they're close, too. They're close.
Sir Ridley Scott stated that in a casting role of Ripley, it ultimately came down to Sigourney Weaver and Meryl Streep. The two actresses had been college mates at Yale. Ultimately, Weaver was offered the job because Streep was mourning the death of her partner, John Cazale, at the time of her casting. That is insane.
That is
Meryl
wild.
Streep.
There's an alternate history.
Yeah.
Where Meryl Streep is Ripley, where James Cameron and Meryl Streep worked together.
Oh my god!
Like what a wow! What a different
what
world
a
that.
Weird.
Yeah, what a different world that would have been. Jeez, I don't know if I want to live in that world.
Wow. What if Meryl Streep became Sigourney Weaver and Sigourney Weaver became Meryl Streep?
Yeah, Sigourney Weaver wins like 8 Oscars.
Yeah.
You know, I would actually kind of enjoy that. You know what? Never mind. I'll take that universe. Let's see where that goes. I want to see Sigourney Weaver going, the dingoes ate my babies. That's what I want.
All right.
No more Meryl Streep jokes.
I got a lot of
national tragedy, guys.
Okay,
lay it on me.
Writers Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett were inspired by the WW2 stories about so-called gremlins monsters.
Yeah, yeah.
That had supposedly stowed away on fighter planes. However, during early development of their script, they ran into a writing impasse while trying to work out how their alien
could actually get. Are you sure it wasn't an imp?
I looked at that
story writing demon?
And I was like, impasse?
Impasse. Impasse. They were at the impasse.
The way the word's okay. Spelled.
No, I understand.
Shusett came up with the idea the alien fucks one of them, which was eventually developed into a facehugger concept.
Yeah.
This method of reproduction via implantation was deliberately intended to invoke images of male rape and impregnation, so both writers were adamant that the facehugger victim be a man. Firstly, because they wanted to avoid the horror cliche of women being depicted as the easy first target. Secondly, because they felt that making a female the casualty of symbolic rape felt inappropriate.
A little bit, yeah.
And thirdly, to make the male viewers feel more uncomfortable with their reversal of gender conventions.
I think it was a good idea, in all honesty. I mean, that is a part of the disturbing nature of the alien creature, that you are just, you know, an incubation tube. That's all you are. You're a method of reproduction for this creature.
The first day that she shot a scene involving Jones the cat, Sigourney Weaver's skin started reacting badly. Horrified, the young actress immediately thought that she might be allergic to cats, and that it would be easier for the production to recast her instead of trying to find 4 more identical cats. As it transpired, Weaver was reacting to the glycerin spray on her skin to make her look hot and sweaty.
That's some rough glycerin spray. But you never know what can do it, I guess.
Yeah. Never know what you're going to be allergic to. Yeah.
And it worked out okay for Sigourney and the cat.
Yeah. In the chest-bursting scene, Veronica Cartwright Lambert screams when blood splatters on her. Her screaming and horrified reaction were genuine, just as the shocked responses of the other cast members. They purposely weren't told how much blood would come out, and which way it would splatter on purpose.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Knowing
oh, yeah.
that they would have the best response if they didn't know what to expect.
That's totally legit. I watched Veronica Cartwright interview, and she was just like, we're going to spray probably one stream of blood your direction, not a big deal or anything like that. And they actually showed, like, the full clip, and it's like, whoosh, 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 whoosh.
It's on her.
Yeah, it's like, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. Like, that's what that sound effect is from. It's of her being blinded by fake blood. She's like, oh, God, I'm blind. Like, just... I mean, they really did a number. They really did. But, I mean, it got a great reaction out of her, but they did shoot a fuck ton of blood.
Great reaction out of her.
Yeah, they fired a fuck ton of blood right at her face.
The inside of the alien egg, as seen by Kane, was composed of real organic material. Sir Ridley Scott used fresh cattle hearts and stomachs that were obtained from a local butchery. The egg tube of the facehugger was sheep intestine. The design team tried several things but found out that organic material simply provided the desired wet and goo look they were hoping for.
And did you get a fantastic wet and gooey look?
This particular fact is all for you, baby.
Mm.
The spacesuits worn by Tom Skerritt, Sir John Hurt, and Veronica Cartwright were huge, bulky items lined with nylon and with no outlets for breath or condensation. As the actors and actors were working under hot studio lights in conditions in excess of 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 37.8 degrees Celsius, they spent most of their time passing out. A nurse had to be on hand at all times to keep supplying them with oxygen. It was only after Sir Ridley Scott's and cinematographer Derek Valiant's children were used in the suits for long shots that they passed out too, that some modifications were made to the costumes.
Yeah, they need to have a little skin in the game before they finally decided to make some changes.
I just figured you'd like to hear about Tom Skerritt passing out.
Yeah, I would. I would. Listen, one last thing. Using these kids, great idea. Because it's a great way to sell, like, the enormity of the space jockey. With, you know, by using your children in there to just sell that illusion that's even bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Works pretty well, even though he did sacrifice his children's brain cells by forcing them to pass out in suits he knew were already probably pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
But hey, that's Ridley Scott.
I have two more facts.
You have two more facts. I want to tell a story before we get to those little facts, though.
All right.
I can't even remember the year. I want to say it was the 25th anniversary of Top Gun. Me and some friends, I think I'm maybe like 22, maybe 23. I don't know. Somewhere in that age range, basically. We're at the Austin Film Festival, 25th anniversary of Top Gun, and Tom Skerritt's going to be there. So, you know, we've been bouncing from movie to movie and everything like that, having a really good time. And we're sitting there, and we were looking at the movies on the docket and all the interesting stuff that's still playing. And there was, like, some really cool found footage movie that we thought seemed really interesting. And I can't even remember it right now, to be honest. But we said, hey, man, let's go see something interesting. Like, we've all seen Top Gun. We can see this on TNT. Who, you know, who gives a shit, right? And we all kind of looked at each other and said, yeah, it's just Top Gun. Come on, let's get out of here. And somebody was like, well, I think Tom Skerritt's going to be here. And as we're walking out of the theater, I turn back and I go, Tom Skerritt? Who gives a fuck about Tom Skerritt? Are we taking away from our lifetime movie the week he dragged himself out of to be here? And I turn around at that moment, and I am face-to-face with Tom fucking Skerritt.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm a little punk at this moment, and I'm expecting him to be, like, angry, and he is not at all angry. He's just like, oh, I thought these kids would be happy to see me. I am an old fart. Like, it was just like, oh, I am old. Like, I ruined his day, and I was like, oh, that is not how I thought this scenario would go down, sir. Like, even if he had, like, smacked me or something, I felt like it had a better end of the story. Instead, I just broke Tom Skerritt's spirit that day. And he lifelessly acted in whatever Lifetime movie of the week he went back to the next
one. Oh, man. Poor Tom Skerritt.
Poor Tom Skerritt.
Well, don't worry.
Yeah.
I have a fact about Tom Skerritt that you're not going to like.
Okay. What? I guess I should worry.
When Tom Skerritt first read the screenplay for this movie, he declined to be involved as he was unimpressed with the writing quality and the low budget. After the screenplay was edited and the budget enhanced, Skerritt was approached again, which prompted him to sign on. Halfway through production, he approached writer and executive producer Ronald Shusett, asking if he could trade his salary for half a percentage point of royalties.
Good call.
Yeah.
Good call.
Absolutely.
Tip of the hat, sir. You think he was watching Ridley work and he's like, nah, man, let's go make some money. This guy knows what he's doing. So, you know, he was just like, I kind of got a feeling this is going to turn out well. There was we heard that story earlier in the week that Shyamalan told about Bruce Willis. where they did a scene in The Sixth Sense, and Bruce Willis said, hey, cut to my trailer, and he was like, I haven't felt that way with the director since Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction. This is not what Bruce Willis sounds like. But you know what I'm trying to say.
It's not even close.
No, it's not even close at all. I can't do a Bruce Willis impression. I can't do a impression. I'm sorry. I can only do John Rainbird. That's all I got. It's not, that's just Vince McMahon. That's not even what John George Scott sounds like. But yeah, so anyway, we're back to the thing, right?
No.
Oh, we're not. We're not.
We're not. We've already talked about.
Oh, we already talked about the thing. Yeah. Okay.
We've been there, done that.
We've been there and we've done that.
Last fact, and it's a doozy. According to Sir John Hurt in the DVD documentary, he was considered at the beginning of casting to play Kane, but had already committed to Zulu Dawn, 1979, that was set to take place in South Africa. So John Finch got the role instead. However, two separate incidents occurred which got Hurt the role. First was the fact that he was banned from South Africa because the country mistook him for John Hurt, who strongly opposed apartheid. Hurt points out that he was opposed to it as well, but was lucky enough to get blacklisted.
Yeah, he's like, but I hadn't really made a public statement, yeah. But I thought they sucked dick. I just hadn't told anybody that.
So he was unable to do the other movie.
It's like if some Nazis were like, we haven't said anything. I was like, yeah, but you guys suck anyway. I just haven't gotten around to it. I mean, I didn't feel I needed to make a statement. I'm sure that's probably how he felt about it, but fuck them.
Second, Finch became seriously ill from diabetes on his first day of shooting and had to pull out. In a desperate attempt to prevent further delays in filming, Sir Ridley Scott immediately drove over to Hurt's house in England to get him on board. Scott pitched him the script over a weekend, and Hurt arrived on set Monday morning with little to no sleep to begin filming.
And when they made movie magic?
Yeah. Yeah. The rest is fucking history.
It is. You know what I've kind of discovered as I did research on this movie is I don't think anybody liked this script for some reason. I don't think anybody liked this because it's the one thing that everybody sort of has in common here. And I guess I'll get into it about Dan O'Bannon. The real genesis of the film came from a movie called Dark Star. He wrote that with John Carpenter. That's his first movie. That's when Mr. O'Bannon got the first idea of the script that would become Alien. At the time, he had the idea kind of worked as a sci-fi thriller called Memory, and would eventually get reworked to the title Star Beast. Now, can you imagine James Cameron walking in for his pitch and then writing a dollar sign, Star Beast, you know, to sell
the sequel? Yeah, it works better as Alien.
It does. And that came to Dan O'Bannon as they were doing a different rewrite later on.
Because it's a noun, it's a verb.
It's an adjective.
Yeah.
It's now an adjective, and that's one thing that I liked about it. And it was so weird that to think that there wasn't a single movie called Alien. So it really worked out in their benefit that nobody really had the idea, even though it seems so basic, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, that set them on the genesis here, and there was two things that really helped the movie come along. One of them is they were writing a schlocky picture. That's what Dan O'Bannon and his co-writer were really working on. They were working on a movie for Roger Corman. Like, that's the market that they had in mind for the movie. They really weren't thinking a high class picture, which this ends up sort of being a very well done technical picture, right? They were thinking, okay, this can be a really good B movie. Somebody watches it on afternoon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was the only impression, that the only thing that Dan O'Bannon really wanted to really achieve with the film. However, people really liked the idea of how this alien was its life cycle. Cause that was the one thing that was in Dan O'Bannon's script that sort of stuck with it for most of the time. Was that they had this really unique idea of the alien impregnating somebody and then giving birth and that tearing apart the crew. So people really loved that idea and some of the other scenes that they had already laid out. So basically Walter Hill had come along and sort of picked up the script and agreed to try to basically do something with it. I mean, Roger Corman was only really like lukewarm on this idea as well. And so basically Walter Hill sets out to fine-tune the script. They fine-tune the script so much, they actually try to take Dan O'Bannon's name off of it to try to say that they actually did most of it. But that didn't really hold up, so he got to have his name on the script. I mean, the idea still is mostly his, but Walter Hill added a lot of cool stuff. Like, he put, like, the ranking and class system in there on the ship and everything like that. He added the android. There wasn't an android in Dan O'Bannon's version. And, of course, he changed the sex of the main character.
Yeah.
He made Ripley a woman. Generally, most of the characters were sexless in the script. That was one of the things he really wanted to work on. But they decided to make Ripley a woman. And the other thing that really came in was Star Wars. Once that movie hit, Fox had Pinewood Studios set up in London, or in England somewhere. And basically they were like, people want science fiction. Let's give them fucking science fiction. And they grabbed any screenplay that had any science fiction idea, and literally the top of the pile was one called Alien. So they fast-tracked the fuck out of this movie, and they shopped it to everybody. They went through a ton of directors, and everyone turned them down because they thought the script sucked. No, but like either they didn't want to work with the effects, or they couldn't envision the monster, or they just weren't impressed with the screenplay. There was a lot of that, because Ridley Scott will tell you he's fifth choice, but a lot of the producers say they really talked to like 10 or 15 people about directing this movie. Like I said, Ridley Scott had won an award at Cannes, but I don't think he won like the Palme d'Or. So he wasn't like the number one choice to do this.
Yeah.
So he gets this opportunity, you know, because nobody else does. And he tells them, hey, I really like the script. And they were almost kind of surprised by that. But that's really what drives the movie into high gear. And the other guy who really comes into play for this is, of course, H.R. Giger. H.R. Giger designs the alien, and that is the creative juice that just drives this movie. Dan O'Bannon had seen his art from earlier. He'd worked on film in Paris, and he'd seen one of his exhibits and was really struck by the work, which you would be. I mean, you take a look at his art, it's just striking. Even now, having seen all the stuff it's inspired, his original work is still very striking. So I can understand it making an impression and sticking with him for many years. The thing about it was, it's amazing that got remembered at this time. And they're able to bring back H.R. Giger for the production of this because Ridley Scott just loved the look of the creature.
Yeah.
You know, and he not just came in for the creature, but he designed a lot of the alien ship, the look of, you know, the facehugger and everything else like that. You know, they fought a little bit. The studio, they pushed back on the facehugger design. Like, can we get a little less face rape? And said, Ridley Scott's like, no, you're going to get all the face rape. And they went forward with that. Well, you know, H.R. Giger ran around being like a creepy dude, apparently. Like, he just walked around in black all the time, and he was like, yes, it needs more slime. Like, just doing things like that on the set. People just generally didn't like H.R. Giger around, apparently. He had an office in the corner of the Pinewood Studios, and that's where he did his thing over there, because he just creeped people out. But I guess that makes sense. Dan O'Bannon told a story about the first time he met H.R. Giger. H.R. Giger offered him opium. And Dan O'Bannon was like, you know, hard pass.
Yeah.
He's like, I'll stick with my beer. No big deal. And he's like, opium's a little strong. He was like, it's the only way I can silence the demons in my mind.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, like, no shit. That's what he told him. Or something along those lines. He's like, they're just in your mind, though. You can get around that. It's like, that's what scares me. So you can imagine
so
the kind of dude H.R. Giger is. So, and even from his interviews, he's kind of a flamboyant kind of dude. So, with that being said, you can sort of imagine like him just running around doing all this stuff and making the creepiest stuff you could ever imagine. There's a legend about him being stopped by airport security because they were so disturbed by his paintings. They thought he had killed somebody and taken a picture of it.
Wow.
Yeah. They really, I mean, like I said, there's lots of messed up stuff about H.R. Giger, but the core of it is he designed the Xenomorph. It looks fucking fantastic. And even today, let's get into the fucking movie, unless you have one other thing you want to mention.
Well, I'm trying to think. I don't think so.
Do you want
to say anything about James Cameron?
Don't want to say anything about James Cameron? You know what? Fuck James Cameron. So listen, I was just about to play a trailer, and we're running long here, and you're already hungry, so I know I'm in danger territory at this point. So anyway, people have criticized the transfers for the 4K Blu-rays, and I know this is like a nerdy thing to talk about. For the 4K Blu-rays of True Lies, Terminator 2, and Aliens. So it's somewhat relevant to what we talk about. And they got pretty poor marks from reviewers all the way around, not just fans in general. People were generally displeased with the look of them. Somebody apparently asked James Cameron about that, and he gave a very stock answer of, these people need to get out of their mom's basement. I'm James Cameron. I worked with my colorist with Avatar, and we sat down, and we did these transfers by hand. I'm a professional. I know what I'm doing. You guys need to shut the hell up. Was basically what he said. He might not have said shut the hell up, but you understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Get out of your mom's basement was something he did say. And that was the gist of everything that he had mentioned. And I felt really weird because it's such a Dunning-Kruger effect, because James Cameron has no idea how shitty a job he did on the transfers for those movies.
Yeah.
Because people, and I went to go seek this out, and it's amazing the lack of quality in the transfer, because people are pretty waxy. James Cameron appears to hate film grain in any way, shape, or form. So what he thinks is a good transfer is just killing all that and setting the AI to like maximum. So it sharpens the image after softening the grain out. So it makes a weird kind of fake looking plastic sheen on a lot of like Tom Arnold and Arnold Schwarzenegger in mm-hmm. a few of the movies. Like Tom Arnold gets especially harsh, I think, with his skin tone. But the point is, like, I think anybody could objectively look at it and be like, they probably could have done a tighter job on this. Because mm-hmm. listen, I watch Criterion movies. They do a great job of movies torn up with tons of film grain from like the 30s, and they manage to make them look fantastic in 4K. Are they going to have some blemishes? Sure. They're shot on film. It's fine. I think his weird vendetta against film grain made him take this personally. And that's what's sort of so strange about it. Like, it's such a petty response. He didn't do a great job. And I don't think he wants to admit that. And it really sucks that he chose such a petty way to express his displeasure with that even smallest criticism.
He may have once been an everyman, but he is way far out there in the famous sphere.
Well, that's the thing. You know, there hadn't been a transfer. And listen, The Abyss is different. The Abyss got a much better transfer. The Abyss got something that used HDR. A lot of the new transfers don't use HDR properly. And we know how cool that is when movies use HDR properly. So it's just an incredibly strange thing to know, like, he really fumbled the ball there. And like I said, I mean, fuck him for being that sort of obtuse
about petty asshole.
Yeah, being a petty asshole about it, really. I hate to see that from him because, like I said, he's a really great director, and we waited a long time for those transfers, and they're just all right. You know, they're just okay. I mean, sometimes some of them are lousy. You know, Terminator 2 looks really weird, but, you know, that's just the way he wanted to do it.
When you do that, you keep pushing your hair forward.
Yeah.
So.
Because when I sweat, the headphones slide.
You might have to just.
Like, put it back like that?
Yeah.
Do I go headphoneless?
No.
Oh, my God. Do I dare to go without headphones? That's a podcasting sin. Right now, I'm flying completely deaf. I'm going to play a trailer, and I have no idea if that's even the sound that's playing.
I'll let you know.
Is it? Who knows?
Sounds like a record.
Does it? Well, that's great, because that's all it is. It's just record scratches for 40 minutes, and that's the rest of the show.
Wow.
So I like playing trailers, but obviously this is just the music and it's entirely visual. And nothing wrong with that, obviously. I think it's a fantastic trailer. You've seen this trailer, right? This is just the clips from the movie, and obviously this sound effect would continue to get reused for many, many years. It's very similar to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like that camera flash mm-hmm. sound effect keeps getting used for every single trailer that they do.
Yeah, it's in a fairly effective trailer.
Yeah, I think so. I think the sound effect is really haunting.
Yeah.
In space, no one can hear you scream. I think like a random woman in marketing just came up with that, and they ran with that. It's a great tagline.
Pretty good.
Yeah, it's a great tagline. Well, how's this movie start?
We open this movie in the vastness of space.
In the vastness of space.
We get some info on the Nostromo, which is a big mining ship. You get a lot of shots of the ship.
Yeah, and boy, do we. Ridley Scott takes his time showing us mm-hmm. a lot of the Nostromo. The lights coming on, the ship slowly coming back to life. And this was the genesis of Dan O'Bannon's idea. This was the first thought he had. He's like, I'd really love to show the slow start of like a crew coming off hypersleep, like just an incredibly long morning for them, basically.
Yeah.
And it really does show the blue-collar like atmosphere of this ship. This is not some fancy Starfleet, Star Trek kind of ship. You know, this is a dirty mining ship, and these guys are trying to do a job.
Yeah. The computers come online. The lights come on. We go inside a room. It's dark. There's a bunch of people being woke from a deep sleep. One by one, they awake.
Yeah. They're all just in there in their underwear, coming out of their tubes.
And then we get our first shot of noise, which is about 6.5 minutes in.
Yeah. It's a beautiful setup for the entire film. I love everything about the shots in the building in this opening. It's so damn good.
Yeah. They're all awake and eating at the mess hall. Brett and Parker talk about wanting a bonus, and they bring it up several times in the movie until
they want shit their bonus. Goes bad. Yeah, they want their money.
Yeah.
I don't blame them.
They want to go home or get paid.
Time to get paid.
Yep. Dallas takes his coffee and goes and moves some computer chips or something.
Yeah.
I think they're computer chips. He goes into a room lit up with a all white dome.
Yeah, this is Mother's server room, I guess, or her room.
Her computer room.
Her computer room, yeah.
The rest of the crew get into their seats and start processing data and calling Antarctica Traffic Control, trying to figure out where they are. They had just realized they're off course.
Yeah, because they're supposed to be heading home, and they're nowhere near Earth. Home. Yeah, they're nowhere near Earth.
So they figure something's wrong. Dallas is back with his crew. He tells them they are about halfway from their destination, that they got a transmission which made the Nostromo stop earlier than they were supposed to. Ash says they need to investigate, that it's their duty.
Yeah, and this leads to a nice...
But they don't all agree.
Yeah, this leads to a nice fight among the crew, because you can see that some of them are like, no, I want to go home and I want to party. Fuck you. I don't give a shit about this fucking intelligent life.
I don't even want money. I just want to go home.
But that's the thing. Like, they're just like, listen, you will forfeit your shares if you don't go. So they got them by the balls.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing that Walter Hill added, like this class system, a reason for them to go. And I like this conflict this already sets among the group. And it sets Ash apart from everybody else early on without being too obvious. He's just a corporate guy. That's what they do. Or is there something more?
There's some great shots of the ship and some planets in the background. They take a smaller ship and detach from the bigger one. They
begin their quest down to LV-426.
Yeah, they head down to the planet.
I think that's what, I hope I didn't get that wrong. Fans are going to come for me if I did.
Where the transmission is coming from. While they're descending, there's some turbulence. Mm-hmm. Because the atmosphere is pretty hostile.
Yeah, LV-426 is like a piece of shit.
Yeah.
It's amazing they would ever think to try to terraform that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you think about it, that's a weird thing in the second movie that they just did without questioning. But
horrible, like, windstorm?
Yeah, it seems like a really lousy place to settle a colony.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I guess that's how it goes with terraforming. I don't know. What do I know about it?
They land the ship, but it's a rough landing. Some shit gets fucked up in the ship.
Yeah, some shit does get fucked up. I mean, like I said, it comes down pretty hard.
Yeah, it comes down really hard. Lambert, she has a smoke, and she smokes quite a bit through this whole movie.
Yeah, smoking's back, baby.
Back when it was cool.
In the future, we're going to all be smoking in ships again. Well, you know what? I should grab a cigarette and light one up right now in honor of this film.
The last time you smoked, it didn't go well.
It did not go well. I should not smoke anymore.
Cigars, yes.
Cigars, yeah. No, I like cigars, but not cigarettes.
Yeah.
I didn't see anybody smoking a cigar. People only smoke cigarettes in space. I think that's how it works.
It was the 70s.
It was the 70s. They developed a special filter. The ship runs on nicotine.
Dallas, he has his coffee. It's going to take 25 hours to fix the ship because there's a big hole in the hull.
Yeah.
Ash asks for volunteers to go out and walk about the planet. Dallas also picks Lambert to go.
So, I mean, there is a lot of intrigue here because they're uncertain about, like, what the entire ping is, like, what this is. Yeah. Like, they know it's just repeating, but they don't have any idea what it is or where it came from. But they do believe it could certainly be extraterrestrial. Not of this world. Or of Earth, I guess.
I figured Ash was going to go with him, but he apparently stays behind on comms.
Yeah.
It's Lambert, Kane, and Dallas.
So this is like a really cool mini found footage movie inside this. Mm-hmm. Because we get slow reveals and it builds a lot of tension from the limits of the technology.
Yeah.
The CRTs and crappy camcorders of the day completely work in our advantage to obscure the ship. And it lends such a reality to the way the ship is shot that you don't really question its existence or anything like that, because they shot it in this manner. Like, you see it in such a plain video way on a monitor, and that's how we absorb real news today. It's a great move, in all honesty. And that was the way they revealed. And then we see these other things cinematically. Small views, big views. It's a great way Ridley Scott does this entire sequence.
There's a shot of Ripley looking at some ones and zeros on a screen.
Mm. She's looking at the Matrix.
She looks at it, and she appears pretty stumped. There's a shot of the moon. Pretty sweet.
Yeah, there's a werewolf about.
Yeah. I only saw one moon, so apparently this planet they're on only has one moon.
LV-426 just has the one moon. I did not notice a moon. I will go back and watch the movie one more time on Moonwatch. I said, I'm only looking for moons in this view.
Dallas, Kane, and Lambert look around and see the giant crashed belly button ring.
Yes, that is the ship structure.
Yeah.
We should mention that we've watched almost all the films again, so we got to see the belly button ring.
We haven't seen Aliens, and we haven't seen Covenant.
But we had seen Aliens earlier in the year, and
yeah.
we've seen it a few times.
Yeah.
We watched it for the new 4K transfer that I
We have not seen a Covenant in a while.
Yeah. I have a soft spot for Covenant. Like, everybody hated it, and I was like, no, this isn't bad.
I didn't like the
movie. Yeah, I was like, this isn't bad.
Anyways.
We're going to talk about Covenant.
The footage from their suits isn't great, and there's a lot of static.
Yeah. Putting it mildly.
They are inside the alien ship now.
And this is a really cool design. H.R. Giger was ultimately kind of unhappy because I think he wanted more like biomechanical stuff. But he was like, they're like, listen, you get to throw some latex on some shit and that's all you're going to get.
Yeah.
So that's what he did. And he also got some bones. He had requested to have bones to help build that set. And they built him. Well, they gave him bones, but they got him fresh from the butcher. So all that shit rotted after like a few days. It apparently smelled god awful. But I don't know why he just assumed they would have like old corpse bones just laying around that he could use.
Yeah,
no kidding. I don't know why he thought like, well, I'll just go to the graveyard and get my bones like I always do.
What a weirdo. They end up in the chamber with a giant alien in a chair.
Yeah, so we see the space jockey for the first time. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually pretty cool. And it's one of the world building lore elements of this film that I think really set it apart from a lot of other science fiction. And people wondered about the space jockey for a long time, but it tells you so much about this scene without saying a thing. You understand exactly, like, this is something crashed from a long time ago, like a bygone era, whatever alien contact was here is long gone, almost.
Yeah, and they look at the bones and they notice that the bones are broken from the inside out.
Our first little hint about what is to come. It's a great element of foreshadowing.
Scary.
Yeah, just pure confusion. And what clearly looks to be his head is retconned into be a helmet later on.
Yeah.
As we get into the Ridley Scott prequels.
Kane gets Dallas's attention. He's found something. It's a hole. It's a hole. He goes down in it.
Yeah, as you would.
The place is vast.
Yeah,
he gets down and finds a layer of mist covering some eggs.
And some lasers. Some who lasers.
Kane observes one of the eggs and there's something inside it. The egg opens. Something leaps out right at Kane. All of a sudden, we switch immediately over to Dallas and Lambert are back with Kane, but Ripley won't let him in.
Yeah, and I think this is slowly one of the strongest. Actually, I clipped this right here. This is the audio of him and the facehugger and him slowly seeing it come to life. And I think that's Ridley Scott's hand, by the way. The facehugger? I think that's him with a glove. Music's very light. Slow oozing sound.
Mm-hmm.
And this highlights another element I love about Alien. There's no spike in the symphonic score. You know, the musical score doesn't have that jump scare. It's a great element.
Hey, Ripley.
Right here.
They're clean. Let us in.
What happened to Kane?
Something has attached itself to him. We have to get him to the infirmary right away.
What kind of thing? I need a clear definition.
An organism. Open the hatch.
Wait a minute. If we let it in, the ship could be infected. You know the quarantine procedure.
She could have saved everyone.
Yeah, that's what I love. Ripley's totally in the right here. Dallas is way out of line.
If we break quarantine, we could all die.
Could you open the goddamn
That's exactly what happens. They broke quarantine, they brought something on, they killed them all.
No.
I can't do that, and if you were in my position, you'd do the same.
Ripley, this is an order. Open that hatch right now. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Ripley, this is an order. You hear me?
Yes. I read you. The answer is negative.
And I think it's one of those things you can see why the crew would hate her.
Yeah.
Dash just opens it anyway, violating her rules and letting the thing in.
Yeah. They pop open Kane's helmet with the creature on his head. Ash is going to cut one of the fingers of the creature. But when he moves to do it, the creature tightens his grip around Kane's neck. They scan his body. Ash tells Dallas if they remove it, it could kill Kane, but he tells him to do it anyways. They cut a digit and acid spits out, burning a hole through the hole.
A hole through the hole. That's a tough thing to say.
A hole
but
through the hole.
I love this level of danger when they realize what's happening with the sulfuric acid and how fucked they really are.
They got to get to it.
Yeah, they're like, wait, it'll lead to the goddamn hole. And there's a great sequence of them racing down lower level, so they finally get underneath it and to see if it's going to stop. And so they are in deep shit with this alien, because not only is their friend in danger, but any way of trying to hurt it or to move it would have caused immense danger to the ship or anyone around.
Yeah. It's not good. They notice right away that the acid is molecular. Yeah. So it's kind of like organic in a sense.
Yeah.
Brett and Parker keep working on patching up the hole. Ripley comes to check on Ash and how Kane is doing. She gives him some shit for letting Kane back in. That he broke protocol as a science officer.
Yeah, she's like,
she's totally right.
Yeah, completely. She's like, hey, when he's out there, I'm the captain. And there's a reason for that if he's compromised, which he was.
Yeah.
He made a decision based on pure emotion of trying to save his friend and doom the entire crew.
Yeah.
He's going to get turned into a cocoon later, non-canon.
Ash calls Dallas and says something interesting happened to Kane. Dallas asks Ripley to attend. They go and find the creature, and it's off Kane's face.
Yeah, Kane is just laying there.
Yeah.
He's fine. They walk in, and they get a non-jump scare again with the dead creature.
They go looking for the creature. Ripley looks at Kane, and the creature falls on her. But it's dead. It's done infesting its host, you know, Bob's your uncle.
Yeah.
You're dead.
Yeah. Bob is your uncle.
Ash wants to take the creature back, and Dallas tells him it's up to him because he is the science officer. Of course, Ripley objects and makes Dallas aware of it. He tells her he just runs the ship, but Ash runs the science.
Yeah.
Cop out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The ship takes off. Ripley, Parker, Dallas, and Brett are all sitting around talking. Kane is awake.
Yeah, I think they're all really surprised by this. And I think this is the only weird thing about this script is they think Kane's okay. Like, they're not worried that there's going to be some weird effects from this creature being on his face.
They run to his side and they're really super excited that he's awake.
Well, they don't think to x-ray him.
He's acting like normal.
Yeah.
Like nothing happened.
Yeah, he really is. He's perfectly fine.
They are all sitting around enjoying a meal.
Yeah, that's the one thing he says for the hypersleep. They've got to try to get some food in him.
Kane is eating. They are all laughing. But then Kane starts to choke. He writhes around, convulsing.
Slowly but surely. I mean, he truly does. I got the whole thing once again. You know I had to grab.
Yeah.
The mundanity of it, I think, is what's great. A documentary-esque feel to this scene before. It's just them eating.
Then I'll taste it better, you know what I'm saying?
You pound down the stuff like that.
Uh-huh. I'd rather be eating something else, but... Right now, I'm thinking food. You know what it's made of.
No. Make a little jokes. It's fine. No big deal. It's a great day. Their buddy's okay.
Yeah.
What's the matter? The food ain't that bad, baby.
You chill for
what? And I love initially they think he's having a seizure. They try to put something in his mouth.
Yeah.
Horrible sounds. Well, this is what I'm talking about. You see the shock just all over these actors' faces, the screens from Veronica Carter. John Hurt completely selling this, going all out.
Yeah.
I love his twitching after the chest burster appears. There it is. There's that. Oh my god! Oh my god! Best part of the movie.
Oh, you make fun of me.
Yeah. Oh my god! Oh, no. Everything that happens that could be slightly bad is Veronica Cartwright in Alien.
Yeah. Well, they get rid of Kane's body. Pretty quick.
But something else I wanted to notice is that the end of that, and you heard it right at the end of that clip, Ash goes to stop the creature from being stabbed. That's the first reaction he has. He grabs a knife. He's going to go right over and stab that thing. He's like, don't touch it, because that's the mission.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that now, but that's a crystal clear reason of why he's like, don't touch. Now, granted, another reason could be because he knows it has acid for blood. But, you know, I'm sure they, you know, they have no idea how fast that thing's going to go. We have no idea how much Weyland-Yutani knows about the thing.
Yeah.
You know. Because we're obviously, it got retconned that they know a little bit.
The crew comes up with a plan to catch the creature, and they break up into teams. Brett, Parker, and Ripley are on one team. Dallas, Ash, and Lambert on another. Uh-huh. Ripley and gang head into a room and search it. They think the creature's in a locker. They open it, and it's just Jones. Scares the shit out of everyone.
This is a good cat scare. A well-done cat scare.
Brett goes looking for the cat, and then he finds something weird. It's a skin of some sort.
Yeah, this is our first sign of, like, the alien molting. We're given a quick visual clue that the alien is going to be larger.
Yeah.
The star beast has gone bigger.
He goes into a room where Jonesy the cat went, and there are a bunch of swinging chains and water dripping. He stops to enjoy some water on his face. He finds the cat, but it hisses at him.
There's one thing I love. It's just random rain in the middle of my spaceship.
Yeah, I never understood.
I'm assuming
that.
It's leaking some coolant, or it's just like
cat set design of.
Yeah, I'm assuming that's all it was, just because
decoration.
Cool.
Yeah,
like, here's our hanging chain room. Where we this is where we hang all of our chains so we can dry them out. But the shame it rains in the room all the time, so they never get dry.
Well, Brett turns around and sees the alien, and he gets got.
Yeah, this is the way the xenomorph descends from the top of the frame behind him as he's talking to Jones, trying to lure him out, is really great. The way it builds the tension the first time you see the double mouth.
Yeah.
As he opens up and sends the other one out and finishes off Jones.
Ash, Ripley, and team talk about watching the alien going into the air ducts, and they come up with another plan. And Dallas executes it. He goes to talk to Mother in the white dome room. And
it's not good news.
Yeah.
It's not good news. Tells him. What are our chances? It's like shaking the eight ball. Outlook doesn't look good.
Yeah.
It's basically what it is. Like,
she tells him basically
not
they're
great. Fucked. Not great. Yeah. You're kind of hosed.
Dallas decides to get into the ducts.
Yeah.
Ripley is tracking him.
This is not the best idea. But I'm sure at this point he's like, how big could it be?
Yeah.
How scary is this thing?
He goes in there with a flamethrower and he moves through each junction, closing each hatch behind him. He reaches the third junction and is going in. They are tracking the alien and they lose the signal.
I'm not Carol Lambert, but I want to get the hell out of here.
Dallas is finally scared.
I like the clips.
Well, I mean, I think you rather, even audio, if you're just listening, you can, it's still a fantastic treat to hear it. Tom's scared shitless. Everyone, fear rising. We're really gonna jump scare.
Dallas?
Because that's what's great. He's searching, he looks around, he sees that alien, and the first frame you see it, we jump cut right into it, and that horrible screech, and Dallas is gone. The guy who is what we know as the lead character of a film.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we're all very used to Alien and the story of how it goes in Final Girls, but that is an idea here. I'm sure a lot of people were like, oh, I thought that was the hero. I mean, Tom Skerritt is top billed.
Yeah.
You know? Even though I owned him once at the Austin Film Festival.
Yeah, you did.
I did.
Poor
I owned
guy.
Him. I did. Damn it. I didn't. I'm sorry, Tom Skerritt. Tom Skerritt, if you're listening right now, first of all, fuck you.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Is Tom Skerritt alive? Not after that.
Yeah, he's definitely burning.
Yeah. He's somewhere. He's just like, oh, did someone just own my ass? You're damn right.
That same fucking kid.
Yeah.
He's probably thought about for the last.
Yeah. He's like, one day I'll pay that piece of shit back. Well, guess what? I got you, Skerritt. I got you.
All right.
I came harder for Skerritt than I did for James Cameron. You know what, James Cameron? Fuck you too, you piece of shit.
Wow. We're never going to get sponsored for anything.
Yeah. Make an Abyss sequel. I don't know why I said that. I don't even want that. Torture Ed Harris again. That's what I want. Do you not want me to talk to the camera anymore?
Poor, what's her name?
Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
Mary,
I know.
What a name.
I wanted you to say Winstead the whole time.
Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
That's the wrong Mary Elizabeth.
All right.
All right, let's go.
The signal is back. Well, we already went through that. Ripley tries to get everyone to think logically and how to kill this alien. Lambert wants to get the hell off this ship. Ripley is hostile towards Ash. She doesn't trust him one bit. Ripley goes to talk with Mother in the
room. Yeah, that's what I like. That's what I like before this scene is like Ash is being vague once again. And she's like, well, you know what? I have access to Mother now. I'm going to get my own answers. So at this point, we're sort of learned that Ripley is now going to be the lead character of the movie. The person who was kind of the nagging bitch earlier, who actually would have saved the ship.
Yeah.
You know, well, I mean, well, it just would have killed what's-his-face, because I guess if the chest burster, well, I don't know. I don't know how it would have turned out if she'd actually gone through the quarantine. They were dumb enough to think that he was fine, even though he had a fucking thing on his face for like an hour and a half.
Well, this is where Ripley discovers Ash's secret.
Yeah.
That they all are expendable and the organism should come back at all costs.
That's the main purpose of the mission. So we understand why exactly he stopped Afakoto from attacking the xenomorph. We know why he let everybody back in, breaking quarantine. We understand why Ash has done everything he's done. And looking back on it, one of my favorite things when I grabbed this clip is the chestburster scene, watching Ash slowly look and waiting for it to happen. Like, he knew something was going to occur.
But he was still shocked, too.
He was. But there's, like, three or four shots of him just looking right at him, waiting. And I love that. Because everyone else is involved, eating, doing their thing, having their little chats, waiting to get back. He's watching. And I think that's a great thing when you go back and look on. So I can see how adding that element to the screenplay made this such a sharper film.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. And it's a really great moment. Because he phallically tries to rape Ripley's face with a magazine, rolls it up and just tries to shove it in her mouth. And then when what's-his-face comes to help her.
Parker,
thank you. Forgot. Parker comes over to help her. Like, he grabs Parker's man tit and basically almost tries to rip his beck off, right? Like, he just grabs it and Parker's like, ah! Like, in more pain than he ever could have imagined.
Yeah, but he beats the shit out of Ash anyways.
Yeah. They all triple team him.
He's a robot.
Yeah. Lambert even comes in and helps. By the way, did you realize Lambert was trans?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Lambert's trans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in the beginning of Aliens, on the status screens that show behind everybody talking about the crew, it has her sex from male to female.
Hmm.
Yeah. Woke.
Very well.
I'm going to go back in time and cancel this. Go woke, go broke.
That word is just
I know.
Ruined.
Yeah, it really is. Like, I have a hard time referring to being awake in different participles.
Ripley rigs up Ash to talk to his head. She wants fucking answers. Lambert notices.
It's a robot. Ash is a goddamn robot.
How come the company sent us a goddamn robot?
All I can think of is they must have wanted the alien for the weapons division. It's been protecting it right along.
This speech that Ash gives is low key one of my favorite moments of the film.
Ash, can you hear me?
The mask is off.
Ash!
Him spitting out all that milk that he hated. He's covered in it, and he has to have it on his face.
What was your special order?
You read it. I thought it was clear.
What was it?
Bring back life form. Priority one. All other priorities rescinded.
There's a damn company. What about our lives, you son of a bitch?
I repeat. All other priorities.
He repeats it coldly.
How do we kill it?
He doesn't give a shit about them anymore.
There's gotta be a way of killing it. How do we do it?
You can't.
Bullshit.
You still don't understand what you're dealing with, do you? Perfect organism. Its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility.
You admire it.
I admire its purity. A survivor.
You can see Ridley Scott always had fun ideas with AI.
By conscience, remorse, or delusions of morality.
I've heard enough of this, and I'm asking you to pull the plug.
Last word.
What?
I can't lie to you about your chances, but you have my sympathies.
Oh, that's so cold. I love that line. You have my sympathies.
We're going to blow up the ship.
And Ripley's got the right idea. They're going to blow this fucker up and get the hell out of there.
Yeah, she tells Lambert and Parker to run and get coolant while she preps the ship to blow. She hears Jonesy and goes looking for him. Parker and Lambert are scrambling to get all the coolant as quickly as possible. Ripley is still looking for the cat. He scares the shit out of Ripley. As usual, he jumps out at her. She puts him in a little carrier. The alien shows up to Lambert and Parker. Parker attacks the alien, but she gets got.
Yeah, yeah.
Ripley is on her way. Lambert screams. She finds Parker and Lambert, and they are both mutilated.
Yeah, they tried to fight, but they were unable to. Ripley can't help, and she knows she's got to get the hell out of there.
She runs and starts the explosion process. She grabs Jonesy and runs down the hall, only to find the alien. Ripley runs and tries to shut off the detonation, but can't.
Yeah.
She retraces her steps and finds Jonesy. She gets on the escape pod with 1 minute to spare.
Yeah, she barely makes it. She gets there.
She gets off as Mother counts down to one, and the ship explodes.
Yeah, the day is saved. She made it, and the alien has been destroyed.
Ripley is basking in her achievement of getting the alien. She puts Jonesy in a pod. She gets herself ready to go into another.
She takes off her clothes, which causes a minor controversy, but the other guys were in their skivvies earlier on, so it ain't that big a deal. It's a stupid thing. I love this scene because it just puts her in a level of vulnerability that I really like. I really like that.
She strips down to her underwear. She sees the alien and jumps. She heads to the locker with the astronaut.
It's just a hand that comes out. Like, you can tell the alien is not
conscious.
He's not hungry. So he's maybe sleeping, chilling out. Like, she is just not that big of a concern to him at this moment in time.
She watches it, slowly gets into a suit, grabs a dart gun, and heads out.
Yeah, she starts laying a quick little trap to see if it's her only chance against him.
She straps herself in and hits the airlock. The creature's, the alien is basically bursts out and is in space, but it manages to attach itself to one of the rockets.
Yeah.
So she sees this and she fires him off, getting the alien.
She hits that rocket and torches him, sends him out of there. Probably the cheesiest effect in the movies of the alien bouncing around out there.
And then we have Ripley, the last survivor of the Nostromo, signs off and sleeps in a pod.
Absolute. 10 out of 10. Love this movie. Classic.
I give it 8 out of 10.
8 out of 10?
Yeah, I give Aliens 2 a...
Aliens?
Aliens, I give that a 10.
No, I think it's a damn near perfect movie. I think they got damn near two perfect movies in this franchise.
See, I think the second one's a perfect movie.
Okay.
But this movie's still really good for
being I think it's great.
Yeah. It's great. All right, so reviews of this fucker. 4.6 out of 10. Oh, no, I'm sorry, out of 5. 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. 8.5 out of 10 on IMDb. No surprise. 89% on Metacritic. But as usual, I found a 1-star review. And I think this person may be insane. Hmm. This review is called A Rat in the Attic.
Okay.
A Rat in the Attic is a good metaphor for this unimaginative sci-fi flick from director Ridley Scott. The human crew aboard a Hollywood-conceived spacecraft diddle and dawdle. They chit-chat about this and that. They eat, they smoke, they look at outdated computer screens. They emit petty frustrations. Finally, after interminable plot filler, and after our space voyagers have displayed requisite incompetence, what would film stories be without incompetence? E.T. shows up on board, less cosmetic than sleazy. Like something the cat drug in from a B-grade horror flick. Now our beleaguered and incompetent crew promptly sets forth to deal with the menace. But our spacecraft-trapped rat has vanished into the woodwork, probably to escape the crew's incompetence and all the hammy acting. Where did E.T. go? Behind the stove? Under the fridge? Inside the computer? Nope, he's in the attic. Quick, fumigate. Oops, too late. The house is condemned.
I guess that's a weird, interesting way to look at it.
I'm constantly amazed how easily sci-fi fans can be satisfied by conventional stodgy stories and cheesy, overbearing special effects. Where in this film is a sense of the cosmic? Where is the originality? Where is the science fiction in all of this?
Okay, I hate this guy. Where's the originality
in
this?
Insane.
Yeah, that's the one way to really put it. And obviously, with his opinion from then, I think it's time to gain an opinion from back in the day. I think this is kind of interesting because critical reception of this movie was above average. Like, it wasn't shit or anything like that. Critics generally liked the movie, but they didn't really love it. Like, People didn't consider this a classic until a few years had passed, but it did make a lot of money, which helped make it a classic. That always has an effect on things. But Ebert and Siskel, they do like the movie, but they're not, like I said, in love.
You mentioned spaceships. We're back to spaceships again. I'm sorry, okay. Gene, but it's the way it goes. Two of the most successful genres of the last 5 years have been science fiction and horror films, and Alien is both. It's a combination of some of the best space hardware since Star Wars and the most gruesome bug-eyed monster since The Creature from the Black Lagoon. The movie begins aboard a gigantic intergalactic freighter where the crew is in suspended animation until the onboard computer awakens them for an emergency. The captain explains why their mission has been changed. I think Star Wars kind of pioneered that idea that a spaceship, instead of being all kind of perfect and sterile like the one in 2001, would look more like a gut bucket, like that kind of a tramp freighter. And there's the crew on board.
Tramp freighter.
The beacon
I like that
signal
term.
Comes from a nearby unexplored planet anyway, and so space regulations require them to land, and they do in one of the movie's really most inspired scenes. They explore a terrifying planetary landscape. They discover an ancient alien spaceship, and they work themselves into a very tight spot while their discoveries are monitored by television back on board. You get a wonderful sense there of something that might have been waiting there a long time for somebody to find it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they go on board that mysterious ship, and they wind up bringing back an extremely unwelcome guest on board their own ship, an alien creature that's the movie's most original invention. Now, I don't want to give away too much. I'm not giving away too much when I say it's kind of a cross between a squid and a spider and the Thing. And it's not real great to look at because its body is covered with extraterrestrial intestines. And the humans battle for survival. The alien oozes around the ship like a mucous membrane from outer space. And the movie is one of the scariest old-fashioned space operas I can remember.
Well, it did scare me, too. I looked away, and I was yelling with, like, a few other people, it's going to hit them on the floor. It's going to come from the ceiling.
It's in the next row. It's behind me in the theater. Right.
But I want to say that, you know, strip away all the beautiful scenery and the evocative weirdness of the picture. What we really have here is basically the haunted house film, only instead of a wild creature running around in a haunted house, we got a wild creature running around in a spaceship. And so this is not the greatest science fiction film ever made, even though it seems to be doing very well across the country.
That's such a weird quote. It's not the greatest science fiction film ever made. It becomes the greatest science fiction film ever made.
There is one moment, though, when the film does transcend just that horror, haunted spaceship sort of thing. And that's in this scene we just saw. As it goes on a little bit further, they enter that spaceship. They go inside. They find the alien pilot all desiccated
from
his voyage that might have taken place millions of years ago. And then they go into that big, enormous cavern down below and what they find there and so forth. Gives you a real sense, I mean, from the point of view of art direction and everything else, that this could have been an alien ship. It's not just another TV or movie creation.
Yeah, one consumer point. A lot of young people are probably going to want to see this picture.
Here they go with their pro-clutching. They've got to say, not for kids to watch it. It's not a rated movie.
Adults and kids are going to be turned off and maybe frightened too much by it. So for young kids, certainly, this is not a picture.
I was frightened by it.
It's R-rated.
Well, we weren't supposed to watch it.
Yeah, there's a reason.
Yeah. And that's it, guys. We both loved Alien. I loved it a little bit more. But next week, we're going to try to take a look at Alien Romulus, maybe. I don't know. Maybe we'll do a franchise review if we can't get to Alien Romulus. I got a busy week, so we don't know.
Yeah, we'll do the best we can.
Well, we'll play it by ear and we'll let you know, guys.
All right.
All right, guys. We are out. See ya.